The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello, and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. Our first article is from NewYorkTimes.com. Exploring the Land of Morning Calm. A traveler gets beyond soul sprawl to explore tranquil thatched mountain hamlets, peaceful Buddhist temples, and unhurried slow food towns in rural South Korea. By Adam H. Graham, September 25th, 2022. Before South Korea became globally known for its beauty products, kimchi, and pop groups, it was known as the Land of the Morning Calm. The name has long been used to refer to the Korean Peninsula, before the division of South and North Korea, because of its tranquil, temple-dotted mountains and serene forests where dawn breaks on the Asian mainland. But calm is not a word that best captured the state of South Korea in the years running up to the pandemic. It experienced a cultural explosion of art, cuisine, literature, and cinema with high-profile films like Parasite, which swept the Oscars in February 2020 and nudged the nation onto many travelers' maps. A month later, the coronavirus hit and a calm return. The bustling nation had closed shop. But on June 1, 2022, Korea opened to foreign tourists again, issuing short-term travel visas for the first time in 2 years, and lifted most COVID-related restrictions for residents. The secrets of rural Korea are not widely known, even to many urbanite Koreans. According to the statistics of urban planning, 92% of the country's population now lives in urban areas, up from just 39% in 1960. As a traveler to more than 20 Asian countries, including popular destinations like Cambodia and Thailand, lesser traveled spots like Laos, Bhutan, and Taiwan, plus a dozen trips to Japan, I assume the slow-paced side of Korea might be similar to those countries. How wrong I was. In March of 2019, I spent 2 weeks hiking and touring through rural South Korea to explore the 8 mainland provinces of this 38,750 square mile country, slightly bigger than Indiana, but smaller than Kentucky. Unbeknown to me, March wasn't the best time to go. It's mud season. Wildflowers hadn't bloomed yet, many trails were still closed, and smog was at its worst. Despite the mud, I lost myself in tranquil thatched-roof hamlets, peaceful Buddhist temples clinging to mountains, glittering dark sky reserves, and unhurried slow food towns where a generation of South Korean women over 60 are preserving the country's culinary heritage. Leaving Seoul behind. Getting out of metropolitan Seoul, home to a staggering 26 million people, is the first hurdle of any visit to rural Korea. High-speed Korea rail trains are affordable and efficient, but tend to connect to other urban areas. Hiring a guide and driver is not cheap, but offers a good way to get a deeper understanding of the fast-changing culture. I did a hybrid of the two, which helped bridge the language barrier and let me move around freely, still allowing for independent exploration and unstructured downtime. Escaping Seoul's infinity pool of neo-brutalist sprawl takes about 2 hours by car. The drive passes row after row of blocky, uniform apartment towers, lined up like dominoes across the drab plains that surround Seoul's bowl-shaped basin and 8 surrounding guardian mountains. South Korea's northernmost province, Gangwon, 2 hours northeast, is a sensible first stop, not to mention the scenic shooting locale for Okja, a 2017 movie by the Parasite director Bong Joon-ho, about a lovable pig raised on a lush mountaintop farm. Guang Wang is pressed up against the infamous DMZ, Demilitarized Zone, a 160-mile-long, 2.5-mile-wide buffer zone between North Korea and South Korea. I skipped the DMZ to instead explore the northernmost parts of South Korea, where domestic travelers have long sought out the pristine beaches, Granite Peak National Parks, and forested valleys. I was headed for Soraksan, Snow Rock Mountain, one of South Korea's 21 national parks, and a UNESCO-listed biosphere reserve in the Taebaek Mountains, a spine running the length of the Korean Peninsula. At the park's base is a smattering of gift shops and food stalls, hawking hot coffee, noodle soups, and fortifying bowls of dokbokki, toothsome rice cakes drenched in a fermented red chili sauce. If you have a spare 8 to 11 hours, you could make the challenging climb up 5,604 feet to Daechong Peak, the park's highest summit. I didn't. Like most visitors, I opted instead for the shorter and easier cable ride to another summit called Gwanggung Fortress, originally built to fend off the Mongolians, whose multiple 13th century invasions left many traces in Korean art, cuisine, and culture as we know it today. The fortress ruins are scarcely visible today, but six honey-hued granite peaks give the illusion of a towering castle and jut like spindly fingers into the sky. The five-minute gondola ride to it whisked me up to a network of narrow hiking trails and boardwalk bridges. From the top station, I scrambled an additional 20 minutes up to the top, where I took in views of the East Sea, pine tree-spiked ravines, not to mention the park's stupas, temples, bridges, and a 48-foot high bronze Great Unification Buddha. It was Saturday in low season when I visited, but the trails were crowded with groups of elderly Korean women in oversized visors angling for group photos with the granite peaks. To me, Koreans seemed more direct than some of their Asian neighbors, more in line with people in China or Germany. When people bumped into me in a coffee shop, on the nature trails, or especially on the cable car, it was all part of the experience. A Buddhist temple stay. At Soraksan, and for much of my trip, I was the only non-Asian in the crowd, with no other international tourists in sight. But my next stop not only lacked other tourists, it had no other guests at all. At the thousand-year-old Samwasa, a temple hidden deep in a ravine in the Munung Valley, where I had booked a temple stay, I had the grounds to myself, except for Bu Chong, a sweet, wiry Buddhist monk wearing a heather gray robe, floppy cap, and a permanent smile. Bu Chong walked with me in golden hour light through mossy woods, awash in pink spring wildflowers, aside waterfalls trickling over weathered rocks, into which old poems were carved. He guided me through the 108 prostration ceremony, a calorie-burning Buddhist ritual in which I chanted 108 mantras and deep bowed 108 times while stringing together 108 Bodhi prayer beads to form a necklace. While ringing the bronze temple bell after our humble supper of rice and kimchi, Bukchung held my hand and told me that I was beautiful. Samwasa's temple stay program is called Love Myself and Help Five Friends. Visitors here learn to love themselves and then envision how they can help five friends, says Bup Chong, taking a selfie of us with his smartphone. Unlike Japan's tourist-oriented Shugupo temple stays that offer ornate vegan kaiseki meals, manicured gardens, and even onsen baths, Korea's temple stays are more structured and might feel slightly austere, but are truer to how the monks actually live. Many have cell-like rooms with cold, hard floors and require guests to complete chores. Few have showers, private toilets, heat, or outlets for charging phones. I partially chose Samwasa because at $70 per night, it seemed like a bargain, especially since its rooms have private showers and toilets, not to mention heated floors. But while overnighting there might be spiritually rewarding, it was physically demanding. Mattresses were no thicker than a puffer jacket, and the pillows were shaped like loaves of sandwich bread, but firmer than a dictionary. And while the floor may not be cold, it was still quite hard. At 5:10 a.m., an inky wet cold still gripped Dutasan, or Duta Mountain. The wake-up call was a clackety and hypnotic beating of the Moktok, a handheld wooden temple drum echoing up the valley. I shuffled my stiff body to the dim, cavernous prayer hall, where Bubchong, two other monks, and the female caretaker knelt in prayer. While struggling to keep my aching body in a graceful kneeling prayer position, I found comfort gazing at the temple ceiling, painted elaborately in a riot of Confucian grandeur, with clawed dragons, tigers, ominous phoenix eyes, and bodhisattvas swathed in the requisite yellow, blue greens, and cinnabar, the traditional colors of the Korean Buddhist canon, called the Danchong, and ubiquitous in Korean temple art. As the room slowly warmed from our chanting, an amber sap began to drip from the ceiling's pine beams right onto my mat. Why me, I thought, trying to clean the sticky sap from my iPhone. Lucky you, said Bubchong later, after smelling the fragrant pine-scented sap. Perspective is everything at Samwasa. While it was cold, smogging, and raining for much of my visit in South Korea, I still made a point to visit Gangwon's renowned beaches. Cheom Beach, just south of Korea's easternmost city of Donghae, is a chill surf town famous for its pine-secluded beaches and sacred Cheom Chodabawawi Rock, named for its candle-shaped sea stacks. Local myth says they represent a man who couldn't choose between his wife and concubine, so all three of them were petrified. Onward to the Hanok. Korea's Hanoks, traditional guest houses, are another way to experience old Korea, and many have been meticulously preserved and are worth seeking out. I continued south by car for 2 hours to reach the Gyeongsangbuk province, home to the Andong Haho Hanok village, nestled into a flat and sandy oxbow of the Nakdong River. Most of its low-slung houses lining the stone-walled earthen lanes have landscape courtyards, thatched roofs, and sliding windows covered with hanji, a fibrous paper made from mulberry bark and used in many traditional houses. At the village center is Bukchonbek House, built for a noble family in 1811 and converted to a hanok in 2016. It's wrapped in verandas and shaded by a gnarly 300-year-old pine tree. Its ninth-generation owners have meticulously restored its painted screens and heated ondol floors, a system using smoke from a subterranean fire, while its hand-woven cotton wool mattresses were beautiful but made me yearn for something a bit thicker. But what it cost me in sleep, it made up for in charm. At sunset, I walked through the village's sandy-floored pine forest and spot a pair of stout water deer running through the riverbed's rustling reeds. Later, I watched wild birds like melodic dusky thrushes, magpies, and bulbuls alight on the fired clay temple roof. For dinner, included in the nightly price of $285, Bukchondok's owner, Ru Si Ho, thoughtfully prepared a spread of kimchi, fried zucchini, and local fish, served in copper dishes with metal chopsticks. I washed it down with a chug of makgeolli, a raw milky rice wine. Slow food along the southern coast. A 2-hour drive southwest took me past scraggly mountain forests to the lush hilly seashores of North and South Jola, along the country's southern coast, including 2,000 islands, 300 of which are uninhabited. No place in South Korea better expresses the nation's devotion to food than these green, relaxed, and lesser developed provinces. This is the home of Bakyangsa Temple, introduced to many foodies in an episode of Chef's Table, the Netflix show, featuring the Buddhist nun Jong Kwan, whose temple cooking includes lotus-scented water and acorns brushed with sesame oil. But she isn't the only one known for cooking here. Slow Food International, an Italian-based organization focused on preserving local food heritage, has nominated a handful of Cheetoslow, Slow Cities, and Jola for their time-honored cuisine, and local female food experts are often at the center of each. It was pouring rain when I arrived in the Slow Cheeta of Jeonju, chosen by UNESCO as a creative city of gastronomy in 2012. Its cobbled main street is lined with reproduction Joseon-era storefronts, bustling with street food vendors hawking everything from grapefruit beer to grilled cheese sandwich skewers. A few blocks away, hidden behind a gated garden, was my next hanok, Hakki Dung House, rooms from $75. A property built of wide planks of sturdy black pine from Royal Palace carpenters in 1908. I slid the latticed wooden doors open to my room, filled with Korean lacquerware chests, an embroidered burgundy mattress, and boxy woven straw pillows resembling tissue box covers. Exhausted after a day of travel, I climbed onto the thin mattress and fell asleep, listening to the pitter-patter of rain on the clay roof. In the morning, I was greeted by So Hwa Soon, the great-great-granddaughter of the house's founder. She has since retired. In 1950-style red-framed glasses and a tied pink silk scarf, she served me an epic breakfast of 25 colorful and meticulously arranged dishes, including traditional family recipes like sang hapjak, made with julienne white lilies, shiitake, and carrots, pink-dyed lotus root slices, and gloriously tender bulgogi, grilled Korean beef. My last stop was the Slow Cheeta of Changpyeong, known for its stone-walled lanes and relaxed cafes and shops serving hanwha, confection sweetened with honey. It's also home to Ki Soon Do, the prestigious Grand Master of Jang, Korea's traditional fermented sauces, an essential ingredient to kimchi, and many other Korean dishes. In the front yard of a woodsy home studio were dozens of hanggari, clay pots, brimming with fermenting jangs, including ganjang, soy sauce, a miso-like paste called dongjang, and the spicy red pepper-based gochujang, which she makes with strawberries, her house specialty. Her family has been making these sauces for 10 generations and now ship the jangs globally. Wearing a traditional green and gold hanbok dress, Mrs. Ki played the role of matriarch with aplomb. She checked the sauces with a spoon made from a hollowed-out gourd. Her adult son watched her face closely while she took a taste, understanding that her palate is the family's most valuable asset. On the 3-hour high-speed Korea Rail return trip to Seoul, I upgraded to the first-class car, awash in red velvet seats and TV screens, for an extra $15, and watched farmland peppered with gigantic apartment towers whiz past my window. Back in the city, there would be plenty of malls, museums, and modern hotels, from the mid-range Lotte to the luxurious Four Seasons. But it's harder to find old Korea there. Like many city dwellers around the world during the pandemic, Soulites developed a deeper love for nature and escaping the city. Perhaps access to rural areas will open up more as foreign tourism increases. Foreigners are only beginning to understand Korea and Korean food, Mrs. Key had told me, as she stirred a 20-year-old pot of jjang. We want to share it with the world as a way to help preserve these old traditions. That was Exploring the Land of Morning Calm by Adam H. Graham, September 25th, 2022. Our next article is from NationalGeographic.com. Hike through mountain caves and Buddhist shrines in this South Korean park. In Soraksan National Park, in the northeast of South Korea, the mountainous landscape is dotted with Buddhist shrines. Overnight stays in temples and hikes up rocky crags make for a heady combination to awaken the senses. By Ben Lurwill, October 13, 2024. The Great Unification Buddha has quite the view. Sitting cross-legged in the sun, with the expression of someone who's just laid down their chopsticks after a satisfying lunch, the 108-ton bronze statue faces directly onto a belt of serrated pine-cloaked mountains. At the foot of the figure, a brazier is puffing out clouds of incense while votive candles flicker and sputter. The spring day is hot, the air woozy with the scent of burning sandalwood. The giant Buddha doubles as a divine meet and greeter at the main entrance to Soraksan National Park, some 2 hours' drive from Seoul, in the country's northeast. This is, after all, somewhere that warrants a grand welcome. It's one of South Korea's largest mountainous national parks, covering more than 154 square miles, as well as one of its oldest, having been granted protection back in 1970. Since then, its otherworldly peaks and granite outcrops have become one of the region's biggest outdoor draws. Both literally, its tallest summit, Daechongbong, is 5,605 feet, and figuratively. I'm here for 3 nights to explore the area, the natural landscape, as well as the culture and history intrinsic to it, through a number of day treks. We should go now, says Kwak Yong-duk, YD, who's guiding me on my first excursion, as the incense wafts around us. We have a mountain to climb. We start following a steady flow of walkers along a path up into the woods. Our goal is the 2,860-foot summit of Ulsan Bawi, bare and multi-headed, a shape that's made it one of Soraksan's most iconic sites. Next to the trail, cork oaks lean over a stream gushing down from the upper passes. YD glances this way and that, pointing out small Buddhist stupas, stone memorials containing holy relics among the trees. Buddhism isn't the dominant belief system in Korea. According to 2023 statistics, only around 17% of the population claim allegiance, placing it below Christianity and even further below irreligion. There are reasons, however, why it has maintained a strong presence in remote places like Soraksan. The practice was first introduced from China in the 4th century. And was widely adhered to across the Korean peninsula. But when the Joseon dynasty, which championed Confucianism, came to power in 1392, Buddhists were forced out to rural areas. The country's mountains, many of which are fortress-like and far removed from the cities, proved the ideal place to settle. That's not to say they're still hard to access. Hiking is something of a national pastime in South Korea, and I was envisioning the park's trails as rugged, earthy tracks, the sort of paths that single out true lovers of the mountain. So I'm pleasantly surprised when the broad walkway up to Ulsan Bawi becomes a set of neat stone steps. YD tells me that the most popular paths have been made as simple and user-friendly as possible. Safety is very important to the park authorities, he says, matter-of-factly. But you'll see, it's not such an easy walk. By now, the views have opened out to reveal thickly wooded slopes below us and sawtooth ridgelines above. Large-billed crows caw as we climb past. Around 90 minutes after setting off, we reach Gojoam Grotto, a 7th-century Buddhist shrine built under an immense overhanging boulder. Lines of spiritual texts have been carved deep into the stone, while inside, piles of banana and pineapples have been left as offerings. The shrine serves as a midway resting point on the Ulsanbawi climb. Two hikers are drinking rice wine on a rocky ledge as an unseen voice chants sonorous prayers from further up the hill. Sitting outside to take in the scene, I meet Mu So Rong, a 30-something from Seoul here for the day and on his way down from the top. I ask him what it's like at the summit. Neomu Mojida, he replies, taking off his baseball cap and grinning. Too cool. The final stages of the walk take the form of a tough ascent up a series of steep metal fairways fixed to the cliffside. I'm breathless on reaching the path's highest point. But we're now just below Ulsanbawi's stony, undulating apex. I look around at the view as a single swallow arcs through the sky. In one direction is a green mass of crags and scarps. In the other lies the twinkling blue of the coast. The East Sea, YD informs me. From up here, South Korea's neighbors feel close. Japan lies somewhere out there across the waves, while North Korea is less than 20 miles away over the hills. Indeed, when a border across the peninsula was first drawn up after the Second World War, as an arrow straight line along the 38th parallel, the spot where I'm now standing was on the northern side of the frontier. Only in 1953, after the devastation of the Korean War, was the present more sinuous border established. Seoul side and its surrounds found themselves in the south. The great Unification Buddha, at the park entrance far below me, was built in 1997. As its name suggests, it was created in the spirit of some distant future, when the two countries might become one again. Up here on the lookout, from where the mountains rumble northwards without a care for national boundaries, such a sentiment feels less outlandish than it sounds. Monk mode. The welcome presentation is about to begin. Young temple assistant Jo Yoon Jong enters the wooden floored hall with a smile playing on her lips. I've just changed into my issued temple stay uniform, a comfortable two-piece of baggy brown trousers and loose linen waistcoat, and lowered myself into a seated pose on a mat, radiating what I imagine to be a ready-for-anything calmness. Okay, good, she says kindly, but the screen's that way, or are you going to stare at the wall? We will finish this article next week. That's all of our program for today. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. You can listen to this program on demand anytime at www.virginiavoice.org.